call the Committee on Policy, Finance, and Policy and Public Health Finance to order. And we have two bills on our agenda today. The first one is by Representative Hyden and on HIV, and the second one is by Representative Okemba. And they're both going to be made up for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill from this committee. So Representative Hayden, welcome back to your committee.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
I just wanted to also mention, I may be leaving because I have a bill up in another committee, and in which case Representative Lane will be taking over, so just to let you know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I move that House File 681 be moved and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. House File 681 would require the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health to conduct an ongoing public education campaign on HIV. The campaign would be aimed to increase the awareness of HIV transmission and prevention among the general public, and to reduce the stigma associated with the disease. A toll-free resource and referral service, as well as a website, would be promoted through the campaign messages. An evaluation of the campaign effectiveness would be required. On a personal note, I have been affected with family members and other friends with HIV for, you know, the last 20 years. It has been a prominent issue in the country and in the world, but in particular in the African-American community. And so because of it's a totally preventable disease, I think that the more messages that we can get out, and then those that acquire it, the reduced stigma that we can promote will be effective. Government has a responsibility for the state's public health, of course, and HIV is a public health issue. HIV disproportionately impacts communities most vulnerable in our society. As I talked about, investment in HIV prevention and education is smart public policy and saves the taxpayers' dollars in the long run. In a cost-benefit analysis of HIV prevention programs, researchers found that significant lifetime costs of caring for an HIV-infected individual are far greater than the funding needed to reach the same individual to prevent with prevention messages. The study found that a greatly expanded HIV prevention program in the U.S. could pay for itself through savings averted in medical care costs. Another recent study showed that a lifetime cost of HIV treatment can be upwards of $600,000. For these reasons, I strongly believe that we have a responsibility in protecting our public health of our state, and that each dollar that we can invest in HIV prevention and education is a dollar well spent. I appreciate your consideration for this bill, and next up, my testifier is Lorraine Teal, who's the Executive Director of the Minnesota AIDS Project, and she'll talk to you about HIV education.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hayden, and thank you, Representative Clark, for your ongoing commitment for HIV education. My name is Lorraine Teal, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota AIDS Project. Simply put, the mission of the Minnesota AIDS Project is to stop HIV, and we accomplish that through education and awareness raising, providing services for those living with this disease, importantly, prevention services for those individuals to stop the further transmission of this disease, and finally, through advocacy to ensure that the public receives the education they need about this communicable disease, and that those living with HIV are treated fairly. I'd like to just tell you a little story about that last point and address what Representative Hayden said just now about stigma. Why we're seeking support for broad-based HIV education in the state of Minnesota is not only so that parents can learn how to talk to their children appropriately about this communicable disease, and so those who are HIV positive and don't yet know their status will become aware of testing. But importantly, we want to reduce the stigma faced by those living with HIV. Just this week at the Minnesota AIDS Project, our legal program was contacted by a citizen from Greater Minnesota. This individual has been living with HIV for a long time. He and his wife live in a rural area of the state. He was recently placed in a back-to-work program because, although disabled, he does want to work. And he's working currently in an office setting answering telephone calls. One of his coworkers became aware of his HIV status, went to his supervisor and asked that he be removed from the workplace out of fear for HIV transmission. This is 2009, some 28 years after the Centers for Disease Control first labeled this disease. Sadly, the individual was removed from his job, and our legal program is currently working with him. And in fact, in a very timely basis, he has a meeting today with his supervisor and representatives of HR from the state to discuss this very situation. It's that stigma faced by people living with HIV that brings me here today to talk about why it is so important that all of the citizens of Minnesota clearly understand, importantly, how this disease is transmitted, and equally importantly, how this disease is not transmitted. This individual's job was simply taking calls from the public, and yet there remains this enormous stigma. Since this disease was first recognized by the Centers for Disease Control over 25 years ago, we have sadly seen an ongoing lack of broad-based public education. Many of us may recall that during the 1980s, for those of us that remember those years, awareness of AIDS was everywhere. Whether you ate in a restaurant, visited your doctor, sent your children to school, or took public transport, there was broad-based fear of AIDS. In 1985, when Rock Hudson, the actor, was identified as a casualty to this disease, frankly, we saw almost widespread hysteria. Following that came battle after battle, whether it be the young boy from Kokomo, Indiana, Ryan White, who was prohibited from attending school, or whether it was challenges faced by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice as they looked at the challenges faced by an HIV-infected physician. Everywhere we turned, there was AIDS awareness. Since that period of time, however, there has been little to no HIV education afforded to the public. And as I said, stigma faced by those living with HIV continues to be a very broad-based problem. As Representative Hayden pointed out, this is a public health issue, just as is smoking or diabetes or cardiovascular disease or many of the other public health challenges that we all face. And just like we would not expect an adolescent to hear the message one time that smoking is bad for you and assume that that individual, that young person, was inoculated for life and never again needed education or reinforcement about not smoking, it's the same with HIV. We need ongoing education for the public. This is not a one-time event. This is a lifetime of awareness raising. Right here in Minnesota, the numbers of people living with HIV are on the rise. We have done a very good job in terms of preventing new infections amongst those communities at highest risk. The Minnesota Department of Health routinely awards contracts to organizations and individuals in the community who work with those communities at highest risk. What I'm here today to talk about, however, is education for the public. Not targeted education, but a more broad-based campaign such as we see on an ongoing basis for many of the public, other public health issues that I addressed. I do know that, like you, that we are in a difficult financial period. Just as the Minnesota legislature, many nonprofit organizations and businesses around the state are struggling during this economic time. The Minnesota AIDS Project is also looking for ways that we can cut expenses and raise additional private revenues. We know that this is not likely a year for any additional resources for HIV prevention, but we have been asked to demonstrate the need, and with a new HIV infection being reported to the Department of Health nearly every day in this state, we know that there is a need for ongoing education and prevention. HIV is a public health issue right here in Minnesota. It disproportionately impacts some communities. However, this is a disease that has been found in every corner of this state. And this is in contrast to the belief that HIV only infects individuals from those high-risk communities. As I said, this individual from Greater Minnesota is someone that I think, had any of you casually met on the street, you would have never suspected that this person and his family and children were affected by this virus. At the Minnesota AIDS Project, we light a candle at our front desk when one of our clients passes away. The candle symbolizes their fight against HIV and reminds us of the important work we do every day and must continue to do to ensure that people living with HIV receive the services they need and that we do all we can to prevent new HIV infections. This month, we have lit that candle three times. Two women, two female clients of ours passed away from AIDS, one a very young woman, one a woman who has been struggling with this disease for many years. While we must continue to invest in HIV prevention efforts targeted to population groups most at risk, we have to do more. We have to combat the complacency that currently exists around HIV and the ongoing belief that AIDS is only something that happens elsewhere in the world. We must invest in a public health-based education campaign that ensures that Minnesotans understand, as I said earlier, how HIV is and is not transmitted. And we need to do that so those living with HIV can end the stigma that they face, and that those who don't know their status or don't think about HIV on a regular basis can access education and can access HIV testing and subsequent medical care. So I would be happy to answer any questions that members of the committee may have.
Any questions, members? Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've got several questions here. I guess the first one would be, do you by chance have a copy of the handout that they're using currently for information purposes on the transmission of the AIDS virus? Do you have a copy of those with you today that you could show the committee?
Chair and Representative Severson, thank you for your question. I'm not certain to which handout you're referring. We have many brochures. The Department of Health has many brochures. Hospitals have lots of brochures on HIV. And I could certainly provide you with some of the information that we do provide to the public about HIV.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I forgot your name.
Lorraine Teal.
Ms. Teal. Thank you, Ms. Teal. And yes, I would like to get just, you know, if there's a general population, because what you're saying that I'm hearing is that you want to expand the education to a general population to say, hey, this is, don't be afraid of this disease because this is how it's promulgated. And if you can give us a sample, or at least give me a sample of that type of literature that you would be putting to the general public, I think that'd be very helpful. You also said that there's an increase of one per day, basically, 365. Do you know, can you tell us what the current population of HIV-infected individuals is in the state of Minnesota that stands today?
Madam Chair and Representative Severson, yes, I certainly can provide you and any members of the committee with current brochures that we have, certainly not with materials that the Department of Health might produce at a later date, should this policy be enacted. In terms of the actual numbers, it's nearly one case a day. It actually works out to a little bit less because it's actually about every 27, 29 hours, depending on the year. So somewhere between 300 and 330 new infections per year. However, as of December 31st, 2007, there were just under 6,000, 5,950 individuals known to be living with HIV in Minnesota. Who are aware of their status. In addition to that nearly 6,000, the Department of Health estimates that there are approximately 2,500 other individuals who are HIV infected but don't yet know their status. Now, that number 6,000 approximately was as of December 31st, 2007. The Department of Health will release their new data April 15th, so in just a few weeks, and we anticipate that prevalence rate, or the number of individuals living with this disease, will increase probably by an additional 250 to 300 individuals.
Mr. Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hayden, you said in your opening statement that there were incidents of cost for treatment of an individual AIDS patient as high as $600,000, and this education system would help preclude some of the future infections. And so do we have any kind of number in terms of the state of Minnesota, how much we are currently spending on AIDS patients through the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, we do have members of the Department of Health here that might be able to help us understand that the information that I was quoting was from a study in 2006, and it's got this is the lifetime cost of current AIDS and the AIDS virus in the United States. So if we want numbers specific to Minnesota, we do have some officials from the department here.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, and good morning. My name is Peter Carr, and I'm the director of the State Health Department's STD and HIV program. Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, in response to your question, the Health Department doesn't actually provide direct care or pay for any expenses related to HIV care. There is a federally funded program, the Ryan White program, that's administered out of the Department of Human Services. And so I don't have that number available. We could track that down and provide it to you.
And Madam Chair, and I would very much appreciate that to find out, you know, just how much support we're getting from the federal government in this particular case, and how much, you know, is coming out of our human services budget. It would be a good number to know. And then just one final question, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir. And that would be to the case that took place that you had addressed earlier, the individual who was hired and then basically let go. Was that a private business, or was that a government, state government job, or can you give us a little more information on that?
Ms. Steele?
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Stevenson. I'm not certain of the setting he was placed into the job by a state-funded back-to-work program, and I believe it is in a private setting. I'm not quite sure. I would have to check with our attorney who is working with him to resolve the issue without having to turn it actually into a legal case. Is working to advise him on how to work with the HR department, and hopefully as a result we will be able to go to that workplace and provide HIV education because of the very issue that folks in the workplace often are fearful. They don't understand how this virus is transmitted and are scared that perhaps the person in the cube or sitting at the desk next to them might transmit. Due to confidentiality reasons right now, clearly I could not divulge who the client was or where the case is right now, but I could certainly find out if it was a private or a public setting.
And a follow-up to that question, Madam Chair, thank you. Just in the setting that you've put forth, if there's a private business and the state has brought in resources to try and educate, I just want to make sure that the individual businesses aren't being blindsided by this and incurring legal costs as a result of this, because, you know, obviously, we want our employers to be accepting of this process, but if this basically comes forward that there's going to be legal implications, that is going to become a legal liability, that kind of muddies the water. So I'd appreciate some background information, if not to all the rest of the committee members, to myself specifically. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, I just want to point out that those actions of removing this individual from his position are clearly in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. HIV is considered a disability under the ADA, and so clearly this business was out of bounds by removing this individual from his position. And as I pointed out to you, we are trying to resolve this privately, so as to avoid any legal costs for the business or, frankly, for anyone. We want to resolve it amicably and provide education and support.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That raises a great question here. And what you said previously in your statement was that if you met this individual on the street and they had no idea that this individual was infected, that there would be no reason that employer would want, you know, would question the situation. And yet now you're saying that it goes to the American Disabilities Act. It is, how would that individual know? how would that individual employer have any idea that he's hiring a liability in this particular process? Now, in terms of a disability, typically we think in that of somebody who, you know, when you're experiencing partial paralysis or something else, that the employer would be able to take into account in the hiring process. In this particular case, that employer is blind to any ramifications and implications, and that employer in this particular case is probably just trying to protect the other individuals that are within the his employment there. So now we get legal costs that are incurred that were unanticipated. My only concern on this is that the individual private employer is not incurring legal costs in this process that should not divulge any confidence or should not be any implications in terms of giving us information that we can't. Just tell me a yes or no. Is that private employer incurring legal costs because of this process? And then I think it becomes incumbent on us as a legislature to move forward and say, okay, is this just? Is this something that we really want to have as an implication in the workplace under the guise of HIV education?
Madam Chair,
I'm
trying to follow your line of question, Representative Stevenson. What I'm trying to figure out is that if you were an employer and you hired someone that had a disability that you could not see, and there are many, what would be the difference between that disability and having HIV? So if it was something you couldn't see, it was a stroke that didn't have paralysis, but you vetted them, you interviewed them, you did whatever you needed to do in order to hire that person, and then ultimately they had a disability that you didn't know, and that I mean, I'm trying to figure out the difference between that and having HIV, because what I think we're hearing is that that would be the same, and that you couldn't discriminate for that reason.
Well,
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, and Representative Hayden. And I guess it goes to the core of my argument under the ADA and discrimination issues and the private sector employers on how much does government step into that business and say you are being discriminatory in your practices when the guy is just trying to make a living.
Oh, okay. This sounds like another issue on another topic. I was trying to tie it into HIV. Now figure that out. I think what we want to do with this bill, quite frankly, is just to have, and Mrs. Teal rightfully so opened the door to talk about that issue. I think we were talking about it as it relates to the stigma of the disease. We were also talking about it as it relates to education to the general public. So that employer being part of the general public to understand what this disease is about. So even if he finds out for whatever reason or another employee finds out, that employer has an opportunity to understand what this disease is about so that as they make the actions that they want to make, they're making it in a very informed way. And I think that that's what we're trying to do here. As we're informing people about diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or TB, or whatever else that we do, I think it helps the general public to understand what the issue is, what the disability might be, so that whatever decisions that they have to make, they do that in a formal way before they start down the legal track.
One more question.
Okay, Representative Stevenson.
Under that context, is diabetes or tuberculosis, are those considered disabilities under the ADA?
Madam Chair, Representative
Stevenson,
I'm not an attorney, so I can certainly get that information for you and tell you whether or not those particular diseases that you mentioned would be considered disabilities under ADA, but I don't know. I do know that HIV is considered a disability and that there are many other disabilities other than those that are visible, such as sight impairment or paralysis, that are considered disabilities under the ADA. I simply brought up the example, as Representative Hayden correctly pointed out, to point to the stigma faced by people living with HIV.
Yes, I think we've gotten a little far afield for the bill itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, in the second paragraph, it talks, about a toll-free resource and referral telephone line and website shall be included in the message. Who would be providing that website and the resource? Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I'm going to defer to Ms. Teal, but let me say this before she speaks, that this, the idea of a general campaign and message to the public is much different than a targeted campaign to particular individuals as we've done. So in the context, and I'll let her explain what we envision in working with the department, but in the context of it, it would be a website and a toll-free line that would be appropriate for the general public and not necessarily targeted to high-risk users as we've done in the past.
Ms. Teal?
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, thank you for the question. My understanding is that the funding for this would go to the Minnesota Department of Health, and it would be their decision on how to use this funds, whether or not they would operate this themselves internally or partner with a private entity.
Ms. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow up on that, are there other federal, state, nonprofit, or private organizations that would have that kind of information available so the Department of Health would have somebody to refer to or get some help from?
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I think that the department is here and they have an HIV division, if you will. So, one, I think that they're well-versed in how this works and what it would look like, and I think that they also, I would opt to say that they work nationally on this issue. So I think that they do have those resources available.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other follow-up. Would there be possible federal funds or other funds that could help with this then with the department?
Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland, I once again have to defer to the department to talk about their funding sources and what they have available.
Mr. Carr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McFarland. The question about whether or not there'd be federal resources available to help support this. We get federal dollars to support HIV prevention, and we use those dollars to support primary HIV prevention and HIV testing, funding community-based organizations and the clinical sites for HIV testing. And that's our focus. And our resources have been steadily diminishing over the past 5 years or so. So the answer is there's not likely to be federal resources available to help support this.
Thank you, McFarland.
But are there other organizations that would have this kind of information available so you wouldn't have to start from square one? Ms. Carr?
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland. Yes, there are. The Centers for Disease Control has an extensive website, for example, that provides information on HIV and other STDs.
Okay. And Representative House?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, doesn't the Department of Health have a website now, and couldn't this be added to their website, highlighted in some fashion that people will see it when they go there? And if that were possible, then we wouldn't need the position that in the fiscal notes is $100,000 to have somebody look at it and make sure it's doing the right things and make sure it's properly on the web. But the Department of Health already has a website. Why don't we just make the Department of Health put this on there?
Representative Hayden?
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, that's great. We've been looking for the fiscal notes, and I'm glad you got it, because we didn't have it. That's a good thing, because we were still looking for that number and we're hoping to get it. So I wasn't aware of the cost, but we have been working with the Department of Health to get that. I'm going to defer to the department. However, I do want to emphasize not just the website, however, the campaign, and the campaign in which to provide a toll-free, oh great, we just got it. The toll-free website and outreach in order to develop a campaign for awareness and reducing the stigma. So I think that the mode is not just the website, though it would be a prominent piece, but I would refer to.
Mr. Carr.
Madam Chair, Representative, as we read the bill, what we saw was that the intent was for us to do more than we're currently doing. You're absolutely correct, and we do have a website. We provide basic information and some fact sheets, as well as the HIV statistics that we update regularly. What we envisioned was that the intent of the bill is for us to go beyond what we currently do. So the fiscal note does include references to upgrading our website extensively, as well as a public media campaign to address the intent of the bill.
And Representative House?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, right now, the way I hear you, Bill, I don't support it very much. but you could change it and adjust it where I probably would. Since the Department of Health has a website, we can direct them to add this to their website in a better fashion, a more visible fashion. And then they tag that website and they go to all the information that you want to get out there. Now, the advertising portion or the getting the knowledge to the public is kind of separate from this. But to have, as it says here, long-term fiscal considerations, that we have to hire an outside evaluation consultant at $100,000 per year to ensure the program remains effective, that makes me a little nervous when we were already adding a staff person at $80,000 a year to maintain and develop new information. If the Department of Health is anything like the PCA or the DNR, they have very sophisticated websites and they have staff that do this now. I would think that they can do this with the staff they had, and we could cut some of your expectations on this fiscal note and make it a little easier to pass.
Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, that is great advice. Unfortunately, this is the first time that I saw the fiscal note, so I think that there is always room for improvement. Collaboration, I think, is important. Integration is important. I would like to point out that I think that there is some opportunity for the website integration and to work together, but we are also targeting, are we also looking at populations that may not have access to the website, that may not have a computer, and may, and still, and typically the groups that we have looked at in terms of high rates of transmission are low income. So though I totally support that and I think we need to look at this fiscal note carefully, I also wouldn't want to miss those that don't have regular access to the web.
Well, Representative Howes.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, Representative Hayden, I agree with that, but those that don't have access to a computer or to a website definitely don't need someone for $100,000 a year to fix that website. So that's not going to help them whatsoever. Your advertising campaign, well, I don't know how you would do this or get in touch with the public through magazines, newspapers, something that the people on a lower income level could obtain, that's one thing. That's a good idea. But to have to spend $100,000 to $180,000 when we have staff and we have a website already, that's where I think I differ. If you need to spend money on the advertising and the program, that's a whole different side of this, and I think that's the good side. We have a good department that has employees that can run the website. We don't have to give them more to run the website, is what I'm telling you. So if this gets laid over for future consideration, then I'd be glad to work with you and help you on that, because I've made the PCA do a lot of things on their website for no money. So it's doable.
Representative Hayden.
Madam Chair, Representative Hobbs, I would love to work with you on this issue and would look for your leadership to help me think about it.
Representative Hayden, there is no money attached to this particular bill, and the fiscal note doesn't have anything for 09, but it does have it in 010. How did you think to handle that?
Madam Chair, I hadn't thought about it, and so I think that the you know, quite frankly, I just looked at the fiscal note as I was sitting here today, so I think that those are things that we can work out with Representative Hobbs and others' help to think through as to how we implement this and to make sure that the fiscal note lines up with what we actually want to do.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question was, aren't we already targeting those folks that you mentioned, Mr. Hayden, that, or Representative Hayden, that are, you mentioned that they don't have access to the web, but we're already currently targeting that group. I mean, we're already targeting certain communities, and what you're asking for is a broader-based campaign. So, in my opinion, we're already targeting those folks that don't have a computer access anyway, according to what we've already funded here. Is that, am I off base in thinking that?
Representative Hayden?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I'm going to defer to the department a bit. However, I want us to think about this broadly and not just a metro area issue, and I think we are targeting low-income people in the metro area, but we have people in rural communities that are at risk for contracting disease that may be low-income. We have people all over the state. So I think that the process is that when we talk about expanding the program or expanding the education that we do that from a statewide perspective and not simply from an urban or a metro perspective. But I'll allow you.
Mr. Carr.
Madam Chair, Representative, we currently target individuals with HIV prevention methods. We currently do not have a general media public education awareness effort that targets anybody, general public or specific segments of the population. The efforts are strictly directed at an individual level, not on a public basis.
And how do you target specific individuals? Are you saying that you target people that you already know have the disease, or how do you know which individuals to target? How's that determined?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is done on the basis of risk assessments. We fund community organizations for HIV prevention programs.
Right.
And we fund them based on specific populations that are known to be at higher risk for acquiring HIV. The organizations work within those populations to identify individuals that may be at specific risk for acquiring HIV.
Which was my point originally when I spoke to the fact that we're already targeting those individuals that are at higher risk, because we know what those areas are, what areas demographically and people that fit into that. And then one more question, if I might.
Yes, yes, yes.
This might be for Ms. Teal, I'm not sure. Is there evidence in similar states to Minnesota that widespread rather than this targeting education has made a significant difference?
Ms. Teal.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for that question. It's a great question. And what we have learned from states where HIV prevalence is much broader than it is, perhaps, than here in Minnesota, there have been broad-based campaigns to educate the public, and there is reduced stigma that those living with HIV face. I'm not certain that I can find, but I will certainly look for research to support those statements.
Thank you. So my understanding is that the goal of this bill is to reduce the stigma.
The goal of the bill, actually, Madam Chair, is to reduce stigma and also educate the public about the need for HIV testing, which recently, in 2006, the Centers for Disease Control recommended become a routine standard of care for adults during their annual physical exam, and yet many physicians still do not do that. So we want to raise awareness that HIV testing is available and people should do a risk assessment.
Thank you. Representative Saylor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for Ms. Teal. I just wanted some clarity. I thought that I heard you say earlier that the concern was with a low number of hits to the existing website. Maybe I just thought that I heard that. But I thought that this bill was maybe addressing the fact that even though there is a website, you know, already in existence, people that need to find out the information aren't going there. I don't know if that was what you said. And then also, as I'm reading the bill, lines 1.6 through 1.9, it just looked to me as though the bill were addressing campaign to raise awareness, and it didn't even say anything about telephone and web, except that it shall be included in the messages. The way I read the bill, maybe I'm just asking for clarification on the bill, was that, you know, it's not simply about web-based and telephone. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, thank you for that great question. Yes, this is about raising awareness so that we can drive traffic to both a website and to an information line so that people can get their specific questions answered. Yes, indeed, as Mr. Carr reported, the Department of Health does have a website with excellent fact sheets on it and information, but there are millions of websites, and so trying to drive people to a fact-based website is really an important piece, as well as an information line or other resources in the community, encouraging people to talk with their private physician about HIV and to obtain information about how to educate their children in an age-appropriate manner.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hollis?
Thank you. Just one more follow-up with the things that Representative McFarland and Scott and Severson had mentioned. I like your bill, the more I hear it, but what we're forgetting here today, members, is that we're the legislature. We tell the agencies what to do, and we tell them how much money we're going to give them. And the more I look at this bill, I think we tell the Department of Health, you do this, and you're not going to get any more money. You just do it, because I'm amazed we're not doing it now. Isn't that why we have the Department of Health and all the public health services throughout the state, is that they do these things? I suggest we take your bill the way it is and pass it and include it in our omnibus bill and not fund it. Make them do it. That's my speech for the day.
Representative Hayden, you have a comment?
Madam Chair, Representative House, let's talk about that. I mean, maybe maybe that's what we... I don't know if the department will be happy. We do clearly have to sit down and kind of figure this out now that we do have a fiscal note, but I do believe that that should be a core competency of the Department of Health, and so I would love to work with them collaboratively as well with members to make sure that we get a message to the state about HIV transmission, as well as making sure that the Department of Health can operate it. The reason for this is to reduce, not only to reduce the stigma and to provide awareness, but once again, this is a 100% preventable disease, and the more education we receive, our people receive, and understand the transmission, the more opportunity they have not to contract the disease.
Okay, members, any other questions? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. I just wanted to say that in the last few years, I've been kind of wondering, I don't hear anything more about HIV anymore, and I'm remembering what you said in your testimony, Ms. Teal, about, you know, all of those incidents that you talked about. But I just thought, has the problem gone away? And I really did think this, you know, prior to this committee, prior to seeing the bill or anything, I just thought, well, maybe we don't have that much of a problem because I just don't hear anything about it in the sources that I happen to listen to for news, which doesn't necessarily mean much. I mean, that may not be comprehensive. But it did, I guess I just had some questions about that as well because I thought it seemed like the problem maybe has gone away. So that was just a comment.
Ms. Gill, you have a comment?
Madam Chair and Representative Gill, thank you very much. I wholeheartedly concur. We have worked very hard to raise awareness with the media, to run stories, to raise awareness within the general public that this problem hasn't gone away. But sadly, the attention has really gone away from Minnesota, rightfully so, to many parts of the world where HIV is occurring in absolutely staggering numbers. And we certainly understand and support the need for appropriate support and help for those struggling countries. However, right here in Minnesota, we have a problem, and it has been difficult to impossible to get the traditional or standard media to cover the HIV story in Minnesota. And so raising awareness is something we need to do because the numbers of people living with HIV, which, as Representative Hayden points out correctly, is a communicable disease, has increased dramatically because of these life-extending treatments, which are wonderful, but there are more people now living with this disease than ever before.
Okay, and with that, House File 681 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Rich. Next, we have Representative Otremba for House File 1707. Welcome, Representative Tremera. Thank you for hearing my bill. So this is a bill that is Rural Pharmacy Planning and Transition Grant Program, and I'm going to yield.
I will move your bill, House File 1707, for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And so I'll yield to Julie Johnson.
Julie Johnson. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Julie Johnson. I'm a pharmacist and the executive director for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I appreciate being here today. Thank you, Representative Otremba, for bringing our bill. I just want to take a few minutes and talk about the background a little bit. I will not go on and on, I promise. I provided three pieces of paper that I'll speak from to talk about the issue. I mentioned that I'm a pharmacist. The members of the Minnesota Pharmacists Association are individual pharmacists working in different practice settings throughout the state: hospital pharmacy, community pharmacy, clinic, government, insurance, education. These folks, as members of the association, we provide services to them, as many other associations do, advocacy, education, communications. When our members bring us issues, we work on their behalf to resolve those issues. A number of years ago, in end of 2004, 2005, we worked with the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy and the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care here at the department and to look at pharmacy access in the rural areas. The numbers and the data that is real is that pharmacy access, in other words, a patient's access to a pharmacist, to the expertise of a pharmacist in the rural areas, was dropping off at an alarming rate. The factors that lead to this are, as you can imagine, declining reimbursements in pharmacy, the difficulty of small pharmacies staying in business in the rural areas, the labor shortage, the shortage of pharmacists. It is difficult in the rural areas to keep the services of pharmacists and other medical professionals, for that matter. To that end, the Pharmacists Association introduced and passed a bill in 2005 called the Rural Pharmacy Preservation Act. The bill had two components. It had a component that is rural loan forgiveness for pharmacists who were willing to move out into the rural areas after graduation and stay a number of years. This is an ongoing program. As you know, it included other health professionals, but before 2005 did not include pharmacists. So I think about 8 pharmacists a year are provided some loan forgiveness for that huge quantity of loans they have coming out of 8 or 9 years of school to go out into the rural areas and practice. The other portion of the bill is the Rural Transition and Planning Grant. This money was appropriated through funds from the Board of Pharmacy, from our Board of Pharmacy, from excess license fees. As you can imagine, in this day and age, there are no excess fees anymore. So our rural grant program is in risk of going away. It sunsets in late June. If I understand correctly, the loan forgiveness is funded a different way, but it's the rural transition grants that are in peril. So I want to talk about those just a little bit. The first piece, it says rural pharmacy overview. This is some of the data we use to define and to provide numbers on access to pharmacists in the rural areas. Rural pharmacy loan forgiveness, rural pharmacy planning and transition grants were started in 2006. So we have the result of giving these grants the provision of plans that communities had to maintain or preserve access to a pharmacist. Sorry, I'm stumbling a little bit. The piece of paper that says Rural Pharmacy Preservation Act, I'm just going to read off of there so I don't fumble around too much anymore. Access to pharmacists in the rural area is nearing a crisis point. When we passed the bill in 2005, we had data from the University of Minnesota that from 1996 to 2002, a total of 102 pharmacies were closed in rural Minnesota. From that time, we lose about 15 pharmacies a year. It was 11 rural pharmacies in 2008. We just got that data the other day. By providing loan forgiveness to pharmacists to go out to those areas is one method of preserving some way to get pharmacists out there in those areas and keep them there. The other way was our transition grant. Since 2006, 20 different healthcare sites in rural Minnesota have received over $690,000 to maintain and improve pharmacy services to the communities they serve. These initiatives include but are not limited to, and I've put about 8 or 9 bullet points here. My students and residents pulled together this information to show you where the money went and to show you what actually we meant by preserving access to pharmacists. provision of medication, education, and pharmacists via technology for community outreach is provided in Cass Lake that wasn't there before. None of these were here before this money was used. Formation of an after-hours hub pharmacy consortium to increase access to pharmacist services in Crosby, Minnesota. The creation of a pharmacy residency program to increase access to hospital-based pharmacy services and telepharmacy for community-based services both in Dawson and Gaylord. Expansion of pharmacy facilities to deliver medication therapy management in Thief River Falls. Increased hospice services in Bemidji, Minnesota. Bemidji isn't... I'll get back to a little bit of detail in a minute. I'll finish this. Expansion or implementation of medication therapy management services. Fergus Falls, Moose Lake, Wabasha, Big Fork, New Ulm, and Perham, Minnesota. Support for infrastructure to allow connection to a hospital from a remote pharmacy location provided in Fairmont. Initiation of pharmacist-run anticoagulation clinic in the town of Glenwood. Redevelopment and recovery of healthcare facilities following major flood damage in Rushford. And finally, the development of a pharmacy residency program to promote medication therapy management in Madison. Please, to just talk about how these communities do this. These communities get together. Sometimes a pharmacist leads this grant application, and sometimes it's another member of the community. We have seen economic development folks. We've seen physicians in clinics. But they get together, have to apply for a grant. They would have had to have done needs access for their community. In other words, they have to show that with money that they would receive from these grant programs, they'd have a plan to either ensure that pharmacist access would stay or they would increase access, as you've seen in many of these examples. I mean, this money didn't go to build a facility. It didn't go for structural things. It didn't go to medications. This went to services provided by a pharmacist. This $690,000 went an awful long way. These services are all still there. I mean, it's only been 3 or 4 years. We don't have concrete data that says this amount of money did this amount. But back in 2005, when we justified this program in the first place, it was clear, and there's a huge amount of data to show, that by investing in pharmacy services, and I'm talking about the services of a pharmacist, the pharmacist going in and making sure drugs are used the correct way, not buying more drugs. We buy a lot of drugs, but I think that there's data to show that we don't spend enough money on making sure people use those drugs correctly. So that's what this money goes to. This goes to services of a pharmacist. Many, many, many times, services of a pharmacist in a community setting, along with the physicians and the other health providers in that community. You think about the services of a pharmacist in a rural community or any community. And I know it's hard to, it's not for some of us. I grew up in rural Minnesota in Tower Sedan. So it's easy for me to picture it, that, you know, here in the Twin Cities, you can't throw a rock and not hit a pharmacy. It isn't like that in the rural areas, and you folks all know that. In a rural area, what a pharmacist does, other than sit behind or stand behind a counter at a little drugstore that's been there for 100 years, we hope they're still there. This pharmacist also provides services to the nursing home in town, also may provide services to the hospital in town. Healthcare facilities don't run without pharmacist services of some kind. These grants have created opportunities and new ways of delivering those services. I mean, as you can see, this is not a huge amount of money. It's nothing to sneeze at either. But these services, these grants that have been applied for, have been creative ways, telepharmacy, anticoagulation clinics, access, you know, places where we can put services of a pharmacist in an area to preserve access that is going to go away. At 11 or 12 pharmacies a year, it's going to go away. And we're never going to be in Madison, Minnesota and be able to throw a stone and then even hit a pharmacy. They're miles and miles and miles apart. And I'm here to humbly ask that there be a way to continue this program. I think we have data to show it's a very efficient way to spend money. As you can read the pieces that I gave you, but we have data that shows for every dollar you spend on pharmacy services, you save 4, or 5, or 12, or 17, depending on what study you look at. So those data are there for you if you would like some more data. But I wanted to just start by giving you the background and making the case for this very valuable program. In a time where I do understand what critical time the state is in for money, and to be in front of you asking for money is I'm sorry to be here asking for money, but if I put myself in your place, I'd say, you know, I'm here on behalf of the rural pharmacists and actually the rural patients in this state. If you're going to spend money, this is a really good place to spend it. Because this isn't dollar for dollar. This is savings. This saves the system. And the continuation of this program is extremely important to make sure we make an impact in the rural areas for medical services.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. And Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Johnson, do not take my line of questioning as interrogative, but I just want to get some facts straight here. Obviously, I live in kind of an outstate area, and I know the value of the pharmacies out there and the importance of those pharmacy services to the local area. But I do want to ask some questions in terms of the implementation. We also, as Representative Houser has left here, stated our responsibility is sometimes to ask the hard questions. These are the dollars that that are becoming more and more scarce for the taxpayer. So we need to take a hard look at the programs that come before the committee, and if we don't, we're not doing our job. Based on that, one of the programs that you got was the one at Fairmont Medical Center, and it was hardware and software to allow pharmacists to connect to hospital and off-site. And from my understanding, that program had three pharmacists involved, and so what that program did was it allowed one of the pharmacists to go to switch their schedule from the morning to the evening, so there was always coverage from 5 p.m. until 11 o'clock in the evening. My question to you, ma'am, is they got $18,000 to do this in a one-time shot. Number one, could not they have made the determination within their own organization to do a shift? We used to do this in the military. You know, you got the watch this day and you got the watch this day. Without that $18,000, and if in fact that happened at this particular pharmacy, did they continue the practice after the grant had run out?
Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, to your question, the grants are administered by the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. The criteria for application of the grants are very specific. The money has to have a plan for, is it needed? How are you going to use it? And is the program sustainable? They also ask questions about what other funding will you get to support this process. Oftentimes, from my understanding about the grants are for very much more money than what was appropriated from this particular program. So the review body will look at the grant and, look at the service and look at the, 15 other grants that are there and determine the sustainability. I don't have specific information about that specific grant. But I do have Mark Schoenbaum here from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care who could probably answer that specifically.
Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Department of Health. To your question, Representative Severson, I did not bring with me the detailed files and reports for all of those grants, so I cannot give you a specific answer about that project. Ms. Johnson is right that this has been a competitive program. One of the exercises that the grant review committees go through almost without exception is to look at the budgets that are requested, look at what parts of those budgets are truly essential for the proposed activity to happen, and what the applicant could probably do without, and often as not, the applicant is awarded less than they requested. Not to the Fairmont project, but generally speaking, after-hours coverage for pharmacy services for rural hospitals is an ongoing challenge. And Ms. Johnson could tell you in greater detail than I the time demands and the vacation challenges that are faced by rural pharmacists. So again, not having the specifics on this particular award at my fingertips, I think it's a decent guess that this incentive was required to provide equipment that would provide a little more relief to a pharmacist or the pharmacist in this community so they could do that after-hours coverage. And again, I wish I had the details. Be happy to go back, look at the file, look at the reports, and provide them to you, but that's what I can tell you now.
Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to get that information if I could. I think one of the other questions is for the one just above that as well. We've got the Glacier Ridge Healthcare System, which is a pharmaceutical-administered anticoagulant clinic, which you had addressed earlier. And to me, you know, how to keep blood from clotting clinic for $50,000 is, I mean, how does that work?
Ms. Johnson?
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, I'd like to answer your question and then talk about, in general, what pharmacy services look like in those settings. In a hospital setting, as we were talking about the remote access and the pharmacist being able to, what happens is they have to have a pharmacist review the orders that come in. And it can be middle of the night, it can be, you know, afternoon. There always has to be a pharmacist reviewing orders when medication is dispensed or ordered or is required in any of these facilities. They have to have pharmacists there. It's difficult for a facility to pay for a pharmacist, which is $100,000 a year full time. It's easier for consortiums and groups of hospitals to use pharmacists that are there that can access remotely and access the orders and be able to do some of those technical things that it has to be in front of them to do. So I think the rural pharmacies and others have figured out how to do the shift work and those kind of things, but it's very difficult. And in the rural area, there aren't enough bodies out there. There aren't enough pharmacists out there. Talk about the anticoagulation clinic, and this is a relatively new service and probably not well known to a lot of folks. I can tell you what I know about it. When patients are put on an anticoagulant, either after an episode of some kind, be it a heart attack or a stroke, they're put on anticoagulants, any number of drugs, usually warfarin or something related, to keep their blood thin so it doesn't happen again. In order to monitor those such that that drug does what it's supposed to do and the person doesn't bleed out when they're flossing their teeth the blood stays as thin or as thick as it should to not cause a problem, takes constant monitoring. And maybe someone from the committee has been on an anticoagulant. Depending on what the physician is treating, this testing has to be done weekly or sometimes every day. And in order to best use a healthcare professional in monitoring that, what they will create is an anticoagulation clinic. So a patient can go in, and this service, probably within a facility, all they do is draw blood. The expert draws the blood. The expert in the drug therapy, which is the pharmacist, looks at those numbers and says, the adjustment that has to be made for that anticoagulant to do what it's supposed to do is this. Now that's altering a prescription, which they do with a physician in that facility under a protocol, if you will. So that expertise, I mean, $150,000 is a lot of money, but to manage a number of patients, and I don't know how many areas they're doing that, that's what it goes to. It goes to the expertise of keeping those patients out of the hospital and using their drugs correctly. Does that make sense?
Representative Stevenson.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Johnson. That makes sense. I guess what my thoughts on that were, that would be under the CME requirements for the individual pharmacists that they're, I'm sure that they have continuing medical education requirements that they have to meet on a regular basis, and that would be one of the issues that would be covered in that Otherwise, we've got, you know, a whole rest of the state that's, you know, that needs to be updated in those procedures. And I don't question that you guys are doing a great job in administering these things. I just wanted to find a little more specifics and just add as well that we are in a continually changing demographic situation. We have big boxes going up all over the place. And I'm wondering, in that perspective, if we've really taken a look to see what the result is of those big box and the pharmacies that are associated with it. You know, you've got the all kinds of them, whether they're grocery stores now or are jumping into that process, and if that is affecting the number of rural pharmacies that are closing, is that a direct result of that? And that would be my last question, I'm sure.
Ms. Johnson.
If I understand your question, you're asking about what some of the other risk factors are to pharmacies closing in the rural areas. Is that what you're asking, if the large big box are...
Yeah, Madam Chair, and just to that point, have you looked at the perspective that the increase in big boxes like, not Sam's, but Walmart and some of these other ones that have pharmacies that are attached to them are taking the market share away from some of our rural pharmacists?
Ms. Johnson,
thank you for the clarification. The issue of what really makes it harder competition-wise for a small pharmacy versus a big pharmacy, you would think it's the big pharmacies that are the main problem. It really isn't. The bigger problems are the decreasing reimbursement for pharmacy services, period. That's hard for everybody. In terms of the increased risk for the rural areas, what I meant to say earlier, which I probably wasn't clear, is that the rural area has decreasing reimbursement, decreasing number of folks that want to go out there and practice, and those large boxes are not going to go to Madison. There are some places they're not going to go.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Johnson, I understand that. I talked with some of my local pharmacies here who are screaming in the last few years about the reimbursement rates, and I think that is a totally different issue that I think definitely needs to be addressed in terms of rural versus metro reimbursement rates. Those are issues that we need to deal with at the health and human services level, and I think would be highly appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Otremba, is there anything more then? Oh, we have a Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Otremba, thank you for bringing the bill forward. It may seem a little weird for somebody from the suburbs to say that, but I've experienced the rural pharmacies a couple different times, and just recently this winter in Representative Howell's district got to spend a couple hours bouncing from a couple different rural pharmacies, and I just want to say the first one, it was amazing to watch this pharmacist in Pequot Lake work the phone, the fax machine, and the people at the counter all at the same time as he dealt with the woman that was trying to renew her prescription that she had filled previously online to save money, but now needed a couple of pills and he couldn't fill it because of the days. But he made a point to give her a couple of pills so she could come back on Monday when she could deal with it, because it was a Saturday, if I remember right. And it was just interesting. I was actually there to get drugs for my mother-in-law's dog. So I was at a people pharmacy to get a drug that the local vet wouldn't give me, even though I had a prescription from my vet to give the dog because it had eaten some mice poison. But I just want to say there's a number of services, and it was amazing. And then I ended up couldn't get the drug at that drugstore, so I needed to go to Pine River and get the drug from the drugstore in Pine River, and I thought, oh, this will be good. I'm going to a different one. I won't have to see so much chaos. It was actually more chaotic at the next one, and what this, there at least he had an assistant, but the druggist, his little son was alongside him in a, you know, like a two-year-old, and he was rocking and paying attention to the, and I just want to say they were juggling all these things. And we have had closures in both in Pine River, the Pfeiffer drugstore and in Pequot Lakes, I know at least one drugstore has closed. And so I think it's really important that we have these programs. And I understand the questioning and why we want to be careful with our money, but we have to figure out a way for these rural communities, because it was amazing. These were senior citizens, for the most part, that were there that, yeah, they have a Walmart in Brainerd and, you know, Walgreens probably, but I don't know that these folks could have got to there on the day. This was a Saturday, so and they were dealing with it. It was also issues with a doctor and the local hospital. I mean, I don't know what this community would have done in either case if one of these guys would have called in sick. That's my point. So I think we need to recognize these things are closing really fast, and thank you, Representative Tremble, for bringing it forward.
Any other questions, members? All right, we'll lay out this bill, House File 1707, over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Scott, would you like to approve the minutes, make motion for the minutes of March 24th? And all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.